Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Dearly Devoted Dexter by Jeff Lindsay, narrated by Nick Landrum, and directed by Ian McCulloch. This book is copyrighted 2005 by Jeff Lindsay. This recording is copyrighted 2005 by Recorded Books. Dexter Morgan has been under considerable pressure. In trying to avoid the deep suspicions of the dangerous Sergeant Doakes, who believes Dexter is a homicidal maniac, which of course he is, Dexter has had to slip further into his foolproof domestic disguise. While not working as a blood spatter analyst for the Miami Police Department, he now spends nearly all his time with his girlfriend, Rita, and her two children. But how long can Dexter play kick the can instead of slice the slasher? How long before his dark passenger forces him to drop the charade of family life and let his inner monster run free? And now, Dearly Devoted Dexter.
Chapter 1. It's that moon again, slung so fat and low in the tropical night, calling out across a curdled sky and into the quivering ears of that dear old voice in the shadows, the dark passenger, nestled snug in the back seat of the Dodge K-car of Dexter's hypothetical soul. That rascal moon, that loud-mouthed, leering Lucifer, calling down across the empty sky to the dark hearts of the night monsters below, calling them away to their joyful playgrounds. Calling, in fact, to that monster right there. Behind the oleander, tiger-striped with moonlight through the leaves, his senses all on high as he waits for just the right moment to leap from the shadows. It is Dexter, in the dark, listening to the terrible whispered suggestions that come pouring down breathlessly into my shadowed hiding place. My dear dark other self urges me to pounce, now, sink my moonlit fangs into the oh-so-vulnerable flesh on the far side of the hedge. But the time is not right, and so I wait, watching cautiously as my unsuspecting victim creeps past, eyes wide, knowing that something is watching, but not knowing that I am here, only 3 steely feet away in the hedge. I could so easily slide out like the knife blade I am and work my wonderful magic. But I wait, suspected, but unseen. One long, stealthy moment tiptoes into another, and still I wait for just the right time. The leap, the outstretched hand, the cold glee as I see the terror spread across the face of my victim. But no, something is not right. And now it is Dexter's turn to feel the queasy prickling of eyes on his back, the flutter of fear as I become more certain that something is now hunting me. Some other night stalker is feeling the sharp interior drool as he watches me from somewhere nearby. And I do not like this thought. And like a small clap of thunder, the gleeful hand comes down out of nowhere and onto me, blindingly fast, and I glimpse the gleaming teeth of a 9-year-old neighbor boy. Gotcha! 1, 2, 3 on Dexter! And with the savage speed of the very young, the rest of them are there, giggling wildly and shouting at me as I stand in the bushes, humiliated. It is over. 6-year-old Cody stares at me, disappointed, as though Dexter the night god has let down his high priest. Aster, his 9-year-old sister, joins in the hooting of the kids before they skitter off into the dark once more, to new and more complicated hiding places, leaving me so very alone in my shame. Dexter did not kick the can, And now, Dexter is it. Again. You may wonder, how can this be? How can Dexter's night hunt be reduced to this? Always before, there has been some frightful, twisted predator awaiting the special attention of frightful, twisted Dexter. And here I am, stalking an empty Chef Boyardee ravioli can that is guilty of nothing worse than bland sauce. Here I am, frittering away precious time, losing a game I have not played since I was 10. Even worse, I am it. 1, 2, 3, I call out, ever the fair and honest gamesman. How can this be? How can Dexter the demon feel the weight of that moon and not be off among the entrails, slicing the life from someone who needs very badly to feel the edge of Dexter's keen judgment? How is it possible on this kind of night for the cold Avenger to refuse to take the dark passenger out for a spin? 4, 5, 6. Harry, my wise foster father, had taught me the careful balance of need and knife. He had taken a boy in whom he saw the unstoppable need to kill, no changing that, and Harry had molded him into a man who only killed the killers. Dexter, the no-bloodhound, who hid behind a human-seeming face and tracked down the truly naughty serial killers who killed without code. And I would have been one of them, if not for the Harry plan.
There are plenty of people who deserve it, Dexter,
my wonderful foster cop father had said.
7, 8, 9.
He had taught me how to find these special playmates, how to be sure they deserved a social call from me and my dark passenger. And even better, he taught me how to get away with it, as only a cop could teach. He had helped me to build a plausible hidey hole of a life, and drummed into me that I must fit in, always. Be relentlessly normal in all things. And so I had learned how to dress neatly and smile and brush my teeth. I had become a perfect fake human, saying the stupid and pointless things that humans say to each other all day long. No one suspected what crouched behind my perfect imitation smile. No one except my foster sister, Deborah, of course. But she was coming to accept the real me. After all, I could have been much worse. I could have been a vicious, raving monster who killed and killed and left towers of rotting flesh in my wake. Instead, here I was on the side of truth, justice, and the American way. Still a monster, of course, but I cleaned up nicely afterward. And I was our monster. Dressed in red, white, and blue, 100% synthetic virtue. And on those nights when the moon is loudest, I find the others, those who prey on the innocent and do not play by the rules. And I make them go away in small, carefully wrapped pieces. This elegant formula had worked well through years of happy inhumanity. In between playdates, I maintained my perfectly average lifestyle from a persistently ordinary apartment. I was never late to work. I made the right jokes with co-workers. And I was useful and unobtrusive in all things, just as Harry had taught me. My life as an android was neat, balanced, and had real redeeming social value. Until now. Somehow, here I was on a just-right night, playing kick the can with a flock of children, instead of playing slice the slasher with a carefully chosen friend. And in a little while, when the game was over, I would take Cody and Aster into their mother Rita's house, and she would bring me a can of beer, tuck the kids into bed, and sit beside me on the couch. How could this be? Was the dark passenger slipping into early retirement? Had Dexter mellowed? Had I somehow turned the corner of the long, dark hall and come out on the wrong end as Dexter domestic? Would I ever again place that one drop of blood on the neat glass slide, as I always did, my trophy from the hunt? 10! Ready or not, here I come! Yes, indeed, here I came. But to what? It started, of course, with Sergeant Doakes. Every superhero must have an archenemy, and he was mine. I had done absolutely nothing to him, and yet he had chosen to hound me, harry me for my good work. Me and my shadow. And the irony of it, me, a hard-working blood-spatter pattern analyst for the very same police force that employed him, we were on the same team. Was it fair for him to pursue me like this, merely because every now and then I did a little bit of moonlighting? I knew Sergeant Doakes far better than I really wanted to, much more than just from our professional connection. I had made it my business to find out about him for one simple reason. He had never liked me, in spite of the fact that I take great pride in being charming and cheerful on a world-class level. But it almost seemed like Doakes could tell it was all fake. All my handmade heartiness bounced off him like June bugs off a windshield. This naturally made me curious. I mean, really, what kind of person could possibly dislike me? And so I had studied him just a little, and I found out. The kind of person who could possibly dislike Debonair Dexter was 48, African-American, and held the department's record for the bench press. According to the casual gossip I had picked up, he was an Army vet, and since coming to the department had been involved in several fatal shootings, all of which internal affairs had judged to be righteous. But more important than all this, I had discovered firsthand that somewhere behind the deep anger that always burned in his eyes, there lurked an echo of a chuckle from my own dark passenger. It was just a tiny little chime of a very small bell, but I was sure. Doakes was sharing space with something, just like I was. Not the same thing, but something very similar. A panther to my tiger. Doakes was a cop, but he was also a cold killer. I had no real proof of this, but I was as sure as I could be without seeing him crush a jaywalker's larynx. A reasonable being might think that he and I could find some common ground, have a cup of coffee and compare our passengers, exchange trade talk and chit-chat about dismemberment techniques. But no, Doakes wanted me dead, and I found it difficult to share his point of view. Doakes had been working with Detective LaGuerta at the time of her somewhat suspicious death, and since then his feelings toward me had grown to be a bit more active than simple loathing. Doakes was convinced that I'd had something to do with LaGuerta's death. This was totally untrue and completely unfair. All I had done was watch. Where's the harm in that? Of course I had helped the real killer escape. But what could you expect? What kind of person would turn in his own brother? Especially when he did such neat work. Well, live and let live, I always say. Or quite often, anyway. Sergeant Doakes could think what he wanted to think, and that was fine with me. There are still very few laws against thinking, although I'm sure they're working hard on that in Washington. No, whatever suspicions the good sergeant had about me, he was welcome to them. But now that he had decided to act on his impure thoughts, my life was a shambles. Dexter derailed was fast becoming Dexter demented. And why? How had this whole nasty mess begun? All I had done was try to be myself. Chapter 2. There are nights every now and then when the dark passenger really must get out to play. It's like walking a dog. You can ignore the barking and scratching at the door for only so long, and then you must take the beast outside. Not too long after Detective LaGuerta's funeral, there came a time when it seemed reasonable to listen to the whispers from the back seat and start to plan a small adventure. I had located a perfect playmate, a very plausible real estate salesman named McGregor. He was a happy, cheerful man who loved selling houses to families with children, especially young boys. McGregor was extremely fond of boys between the ages of 5 and 7. He had been lethally fond of 5 that I was sure of, and quite likely several more. He was clever and careful, and without a visit from Dark Scout Dexter, he would probably stay lucky for a long time. It's hard to blame the police, at least this once. After all, when a young child goes missing, very few people would say, "Aha! Who sold his family their house?" But of course, very few people are Dexter. This is generally a good thing, but in this case it came in handy to be me. 4 months after reading a story in the paper about a missing boy, I read a similar story. The boys were the same age. Details like that always ring a small bell and send a Mr. Rogers whisper trickling through my brain. "Hello, neighbor." And so I dug up the first story and compared. I noticed that in both cases the paper milked the grief of the families by mentioning that they had recently moved into new homes. I heard a small chuckle from the shadows, and I looked a little closer. It really was quite subtle. Detective Dexter had to dig quite a bit, because at first there didn't seem to be any connection. The families in question were in different neighborhoods, which ruled out a great many possibilities. They went to different churches, different schools, and used different moving companies. But when the dark passenger laughs, somebody is usually doing something funny. And I finally found the connection. Both houses had been listed with the same real estate agency, a small outfit in South Miami, with only one agent, a cheerful and friendly man named Randy McGregor. I dug a little more. McGregor was divorced and lived alone in a small concrete block house off Old Cutler Road in South Miami. He kept a 26-foot cabin cruiser at Matheson Hammock Marina, which was relatively close to his house. The boat would also be an extremely convenient playpen, a way to get his little chums off alone on the bounding main, where he would not be seen nor heard while he explored. A real Columbus of pain. And for that matter, it would provide a splendid way to dispose of the messy leftovers. Just a few miles out from Miami, the Gulf Stream provided a nearly bottomless dumping ground. No wonder the boys' bodies were never found. The technique made such good sense that I wondered why I hadn't thought of it to recycle my own leftovers. Silly me. I only used my little boat for fishing and riding around the bay. And here McGregor had come up with a whole new way to enjoy an evening on the water. It was a very neat idea, and it instantly moved McGregor right to the top of my list. Call me unreasonable, even illogical, since I generally have very little use for humans, but for some reason I care about kids. And when I find someone who preys on children, It is very much as if they have slipped the dark maitre d' $20 to move to the front of the line. I would happily unclip the velvet rope and bring McGregor right in, assuming he was doing what it looked like he was doing. Of course, I had to be absolutely certain. I had always tried to avoid slicing up the wrong person, and it would be a shame to start now, even with a real estate salesman. It occurred to me that the best way to make sure would be to visit the boat in question. Happily for me, the very next day it was raining, as it generally rains every day in July. But this had the look of an all-day storm, which made it just what the Dexter ordered. I left my job at the Miami-Dade Police Forensics Lab early and cut over to Lejeune, taking it all the way to Old Cutler Road. I turned left into Matheson Hammock. As I'd hoped, it seemed deserted. But about 100 yards ahead, I knew there was a guard booth, where someone would be waiting eagerly to take $4 from me for the great privilege of entering the park. It seemed like a good idea not to make an appearance at the guard booth. Of course, saving the $4 was very important, but even more so was that on a rainy day in the middle of the week, I might be just a little bit conspicuous, which is something I like to avoid, particularly in the course of my hobby. On the left side of the road was a small parking lot that served the picnic area. An old coral rock picnic shelter stood beside a lake on the right. I parked my car and pulled on a bright yellow foul-weather jacket. It made me feel very nautical. Just the thing to wear for breaking into a homicidal pedophile's boat. It also made me highly visible, but I was not terribly worried about that. I would take the bicycle path that ran parallel to the road. It was screened in by mangroves, and in the unlikely event that the guard stuck his head out of the booth and into the rain, he would see nothing but a bright yellow blur jogging by. Just a determined runner, out for his afternoon trot, come rain or shine. And trot I did, moving about a quarter of a mile down the path. As I had hoped, there was no sign of life at the guard booth, and I jogged to the large parking lot by the water. The last row of docks off to the right was home to a cluster of boats slightly smaller than the big sports fishermen and millionaires' toys tied up closer to the road. McGregor's modest 26-footer, the Osprey, was near the end. The marina was deserted, and I went blithely through the gate in the chain-link fence, past a sign that said, "Only boat owners permitted on docks." I tried to feel guilty about violating such an important command, but it was beyond me. The lower half of the sign said, "No fishing off docks or in marina area," and I promised myself that I would avoid fishing at all costs, which made me feel better about breaking the other rule. The Osprey was 5 or 6 years old and showed only a few signs of wear from the Florida weather. The deck and rails were scrubbed clean, and I was careful not to leave scuff marks as I climbed aboard. For some reason, the locks on boats are never very complicated. Perhaps sailors are more honest than landlubbers. In any case, it took only a few seconds for me to pick the lock and slip inside the Osprey. The cabin did not have the musty smell of baked mildew that so many boats get when they are sealed up, even for a few hours in the subtropical sun. Instead, there was a faint tang of pine sol in the air, as though someone had scrubbed so thoroughly that no germs or odors could hope to survive. There was a small table, a galley, and one of those little TV VCR units on a railed shelf, with a stack of movies beside it. Spider-Man, Brother Bear, Finding Nemo. I wondered how many boys McGregor had sent over the side to find Nemo. I dearly hoped that soon Nemo would find him. I stepped to the galley area and began to open drawers. One was filled with candy, the next with plastic action figures, and the third was absolutely crammed with rolls of duct tape. Duct tape is a wonderful thing, and as I know very well, it can be used for many remarkable and useful things. But I did think that having 10 rolls of it stuffed in a drawer on your boat was a bit excessive. Unless, of course, you were using it for some specific purpose that required a great deal of it. Perhaps a science project involving multiple young boys? Just a hunch, of course, based on the way I use it. Not on young boys, of course, but on upstanding citizens like, for instance, McGregor. It had started to seem likely, and the dark passenger flicked his dry lizard tongue with anticipation. I went down the steps into the small forward area the salesman probably called the stateroom. It wasn't a terribly elegant bed, just a thin foam rubber pad on a raised shelf. I touched the mattress and it crackled under the fabric, a rubber casing. I rolled the mattress to one side. There were 4 ring bolts screwed into the shelf, one on each corner. I lifted the hatch beneath the mattress. One might reasonably expect to find a certain amount of chain on a boat, but the accompanying handcuffs did not strike me as being quite so nautical. Of course, there might be a very good explanation. It was possible that McGregor used them on quarrelsome fish. Under the chain and handcuffs, there were 5 anchors. That could very well be a good idea on a yacht that was meant to cruise around the world, but it seemed a bit much for a small weekend boat. What on earth could they be for? If I was taking my little boat out into the deep water with a series of small bodies I wished to dispose of cleanly and completely, what would I do with so many anchors? And of course, when you put it that way, it seemed obvious that the next time McGregor went cruising with a little friend, he would come back with only 4 anchors under the bunk. I was certainly gathering enough small details to make a very interesting picture. Still life without children. But so far I had not found anything that could not be explained away as massive coincidence, and I needed to be absolutely sure. I had to have 1 overwhelmingly conclusive piece of evidence, something so completely unambiguous that it would satisfy the hairy code. I found it in a drawer to the right of the bunk. There were 3 small drawers built into the bulkhead of the boat. The interior of the bottom one seemed to be a few inches shorter than the other 2. It was possible that it was supposed to be, that it was shortened by the curve of the hull. But I have studied humans for many years now, and this had made me deeply suspicious. I pulled the drawer all the way out and, sure enough, there was a small secret compartment on the back end of the drawer. And inside the secret compartment? Since I am not actually a real human being, my emotional responses are generally limited to what I have learned to fake. So I did not feel shock, outrage, anger, or even bitter resolve. They are very difficult emotions to do convincingly. And there was no audience to do them for, so why bother? But I did feel a slow, cold wind from the dark back seat sweep up my spine and blow dry leaves over the floor of my lizard brain. I could identify 5 different naked boys in the stack of photographs, arranged in a variety of poses, as if McGregor was still searching for a defining style. And yes, indeed, he really was a spendthrift with his duct tape. In one of the pictures, the boy looked like he was in a silver-gray cocoon, with only certain areas exposed. What McGregor left exposed told me a great deal about him. As I had suspected, he was not the kind of man most parents would wish for a scoutmaster. The photos were good quality, taken from many different angles. One series in particular stood out. A pale, flabby, naked man in a black hood stood beside the tightly taped boy, almost like a trophy shot. From the shape and coloring of the body, I was quite sure the man was McGregor, even though the hood covered his face. And as I flipped through the pictures, I had two very interesting thoughts. The first was, aha, meaning, of course, that there was absolutely no doubt about what McGregor had been doing, and he was now the lucky grand prize winner in the Dark Passengers Clearing House sweepstakes. And the second thought, somewhat more troubling, was this. Who was taking the pictures? There were too many different angles for the pictures to have been taken automatically. And as I flipped through them a second time, I noticed, in two shots that had been snapped from above, the pointy toe of what looked like a red cowboy boot. McGregor had an accomplice. The word sounded so very court TV, but there it was, and I couldn't think of a better way to say it. He hadn't done all this alone. Someone had gone along and, if nothing else, had watched and taken pictures. I blush to admit that I have some modest knowledge and talent in the area of semi-regular mayhem, but I had never before run into anything like this. Trophy shots, yes. After all, I had my little box of slides, each with a single drop of blood on them, to commemorate every one of my adventures. Perfectly normal to keep some kind of souvenir. But to have a second person present, watching and taking pictures, turned a very private act into a kind of performance. It was absolutely indecent. The man was a pervert. If only I had been capable of moral outrage, I am quite sure I would have been full of it. As it was, though, I found myself more eager than ever to get viscerally acquainted with McGregor. It was stiflingly hot on the boat, and my wonderfully chic foul-weather suit was not helping. I felt like a bright yellow tea bag. I picked several of the clearest pictures and put them in my pocket. I returned the rest to their compartment, tidied the bunk, and went back up into the main cabin. As far as I could tell from peeking out the window, or did I have to call it a porthole, there was no one lurking about and observing me in a furtive manner. I slipped out the door, making sure it locked behind me, and strolled off through the rain. From the many movies I have seen over the years, I knew very well that walking in the rain is the correct setting for reflecting on human perfidy, and so I did just that. Oh, that wicked McGregor and his shutterbug friend. How could they be such vile wretches? That sounded about right, and it was all I could come up with. I hoped it was enough to satisfy the formula, because it was far more fun to reflect on my own perfidy, and how I might feed it by arranging a playdate with McGregor. I could feel a rising tide of dark delight flooding in from the deepest dungeons of Castle Dexter and building up at the spillways. And soon it would pour out on McGregor. There was no longer any room for doubt, of course. Harry himself would acknowledge that the photographs were more than enough proof, and an eager chuckle from the dark back seat sanctified the project. McGregor and I would go exploring together, and then the special bonus of finding his friend in the cowboy boots. He would have to follow McGregor as soon as possible, of course. No rest for the wicked. It was like a two for the price of one sale. Absolutely irresistible. Filled with my happy thoughts, I didn't even notice the rain as I strode manfully and rapidly back to my car. I had a great deal to do. Chapter 3. It's always a bad idea to follow a regular routine, particularly if you are a homicidal pedophile who has come to the attention of Dexter the Avenger. Happily for me, no one had ever given McGregor this vital bit of information, and so it was quite easy for me to find him leaving his office at 6:30 p.m., as he did every day. He came out the back door, locked it, and climbed into his big Ford SUV, a perfect vehicle for hauling people around to look at houses, or for carrying bundled-up little boys down to the dock. He pulled out into the traffic, and I followed him home to his modest concrete block house on Southwest 80th Street. There was quite a bit of traffic going by the house. I turned onto a small side street half a block away and parked unobtrusively where I had a good view. There was a tall, thick hedge running down the far side of McGregor's lot that would keep the neighbors from seeing anything that went on in his yard. I sat in my car and pretended to look at a map for about 10 minutes, just long enough to scheme and be sure that he wasn't going anywhere. When he came out of his house and began to putter around the yard, shirtless and wearing a pair of battered madras shorts, I knew how I would do it. I headed for home to get ready. In spite of the fact that I normally have a robust and healthy appetite, I always find it difficult to eat before one of my little adventures. My interior associate quivers with rising anticipation. The moon burbles louder and louder in my veins as the night slides over the city, and thoughts of food begin to seem so very ordinary. And so instead of enjoying a leisurely, high-protein dinner, I paced my apartment, eager to begin, but still cool enough to wait, letting daytime Dexter melt quietly into the background and feeling the intoxicating surge of power as the dark passenger slowly took the wheel and checked the controls. It was always an exhilarating sensation to allow myself to be pulled into the back seat and let the passenger drive. Shadows seem to grow sharper edges as the darkness fades into a lively gray that brings everything into much sharper focus. Small sounds become loud and distinct. My skin tingles. My breath roars in and out, and even the air comes alive with smells that were certainly not noticeable during the boring and normal day. I was never more alive than when the dark passenger was driving. I forced myself to sit in my easy chair, and I held myself in, feeling the need roll over me and leave behind a high tide of readiness. Each breath felt like a blast of cold air sweeping through me and pumping me up bigger and brighter, until I was like an enormous, invincible beacon of steel, ready to slash through the now dark city. And then my chair became a stupid little thing, a hiding place for mice, and only the night was big enough. And it was time. Out we went, into the bright night, the moonlight hammering at me, and the dead roses breath of the Miami night blowing across my skin. And in almost no time at all, I was there, in the shadows cast by McGregor's hedge, watching and waiting and listening, just for now, to the caution that curled around my wrist and whispered, "Patience." It seemed pathetic that he couldn't see something that gleamed as brightly as I did, and the thought gave me another surge of strength. I pulled on my white silk mask, and I was ready to begin. Slowly, invisibly, I moved from the darkness of the hedge and placed a child's plastic piano keyboard beneath his window. putting it under a gladiolus bush so it would not be seen immediately. It was bright red and blue, less than a foot long, and only had 8 keys, but it would repeat the same 4 melodies endlessly until the battery died. I switched it on and stepped back into my place in the hedge. Jingle Bells played, and then Old MacDonald. For some reason, a key phrase was missing in each song, but the little toy piped on and into London Bridge in the same cheerfully lunatic tone. It was enough to make anyone crazy, but it probably had an extra effect on someone like MacGregor, who lived for children. At any rate, I certainly hoped so. I had quite deliberately chosen the little keyboard to lure him out, and I sincerely hoped, in fact, that he would think he had been found out, and that a toy had come from hell to punish him. After all, why shouldn't I enjoy what I do? It seemed to work. We were only on the 3rd repetition of London Bridge when he came stumbling out of his house with a look of wide-eyed panic. He stood there for a moment, gaping around, his receding reddish hair looking like it had gone through a storm, and his pale belly hanging slightly over the waist of his dingy pajama bottoms. He didn't look terribly dangerous to me, but of course, I wasn't a 5-year-old boy. After a moment in which he stood with his mouth open and scratched himself, and looked like he was modeling for a statue of the Greek god of stupidity, MacGregor located the source of the sound. Jingle Bells, again, by now. He stepped over and bent slightly to touch the little plastic keyboard, and didn't even have the time to be surprised before I had a noose of 50-pound test fishing line pulled tight around his throat. He straightened and thought he might struggle for a moment. I pulled tighter, and he changed his mind. "Stop fighting," we said in our cold and commanding passenger voice. "You'll live longer." And he heard his future in the words and thought he might change it. So I pulled hard on his leash and held it like that until his face turned dark and he dropped to his knees. Just before he passed out completely, I eased the pressure. "Now do as you're told," we said. He didn't say anything. He just choked in a few large and painful breaths. So I tweaked the line a touch. "Understand?" we said. And he nodded. So I let him breathe. He didn't try to fight anymore as I frog-marched him into the house for his car keys and then back out into his big SUV. I climbed into the seat behind him, holding the leash in a very tight grip, and allowing him only enough breath to stay alive, for now.
"Start the car," we told him,
and he paused.
"What do you want?"
he said in a voice that was rough with new-made gravel.
"Everything," we said. "Start the car."
"I have money," he said.
I pulled hard on his cord.
"Buy me a little boy," we said.
I held it tight for a few seconds, too tight for him to breathe, and just long enough to let him know that we were in charge. We knew what he had done, and we would let him breathe only at our pleasure from now on. And when I loosened the line again, he had nothing to say. He drove as we told him to, back up Southwest 80th Street to Old Cutler Road, and then south. There was almost no traffic this far out, not at this time of night, and we turned into a new development that had been going up on the far side of Snapper Creek. Construction had halted due to the owner's conviction for money laundering, and we wouldn't be disturbed. We guided MacGregor through a half-built guard booth, around a small traffic circle, east, toward the water, and to a halt beside a small trailer, the temporary office of the site, now left to teen thrill-seekers and others, like me, who only wanted a little privacy. We sat for just a moment, enjoying the view, moon over the water, with pedophile in noose in the foreground. Very beautiful. I got out and pulled McGregor out after me, pulled him so hard that he fell to his knees and clawed at the line around his neck. For a moment, I watched him choking and drooling in the dirt, his face turning dark again and his eyes going red. Then I pulled him to his feet and pushed him up the three wooden steps and into the trailer. By the time he had recovered enough to know what was going on, I had him tied to the top of a desk, hands and feet secured with duct tape. McGregor tried to speak and just coughed instead. I waited. Now there was plenty of time.
"Please," he said finally, in a voice like sand on glass. "I'll give you whatever you want."
"Yes, you will," we said,
and saw the sound of it cut into him, and even though he couldn't see it through my white silk mask, we smiled. I took out the photos I had taken from his boat and showed them to him. He stopped moving completely, and his mouth hung open.
"Where did you get those?" he said,
sounding rather petulant for someone who was about to be cut into small pieces.
"Tell me who took these pictures."
"Why should I?" he said.
I used a pair of tin snips and cut off the first two fingers of his left hand. He thrashed and screamed, and the blood came, which always makes me angry. So I shoved a tennis ball into his mouth and cut off the first two fingers of his right hand.
"No reason," I said,
and I waited for him to slow down just a little bit. When he finally did, he rolled an eye to me, and his face was filled with that understanding that comes when you have gone beyond pain, into knowing that the rest of this was forever. I took the tennis ball out of his mouth.
"Who took the pictures?"
He smiled.
"I hope one of them was yours," he said,
which made the next 90 minutes a lot more rewarding. Chapter 4. Normally I feel pleasantly mellow for several days after one of my nights out, but the very next morning after McGregor's hasty exit, I was still all a quiver with eagerness. I wanted very badly to find the photographer in the red cowboy boots and make a clean sweep of it. I am a tidy monster, and I do like to finish whatever I begin. And to know that someone was out there, clumping around in those ridiculous shoes, carrying a camera that had seen far too much, made me anxious to follow those footprints and wrap up my two-part project. Perhaps I had been too hasty with McGregor. I should have given him a little more time and encouragement, and he would have told me everything. But it had seemed like something I could easily find by myself. When the dark passenger is driving, I am quite sure I can do anything. So far, I have not been wrong, but it had put me in a bit of an awkward spot this time, and I had to find Mr. Boots on my own. I knew from my earlier research that McGregor did not have a social life beyond his occasional evening cruises. He belonged to a couple of business organizations, which was to be expected from a realtor, but I hadn't discovered anyone in particular that he seemed to pal around with. I also knew he had no criminal record, so there was no file to pull and search for known associates. The court records on his divorce simply listed irreconcilable differences and left the rest to my imagination. And there I was stuck. McGregor had been a classic loner, and in all my careful study of him,
I had never seen an indication that he had any friends, companions, dates, mates, or cronies. No poker night with the boys. No boys at all, except for the young ones. No church group, no Elks, no neighborhood bar, no weekly square dancing society, which might have explained the boots. No nothing, except the photographs with those stupid pointed red toes sticking out. So who was Cowboy Bob, and how did I find him? There was really only one place I could go for an answer, and that would have to be soon, before someone noticed that McGregor was missing. In the distance, I heard thunder rumble, and I glanced at the wall clock with surprise. Sure enough, it was 2:15, time for the daily afternoon storm. I had moped all the way through my lunch hour, very unlike me. Still, the storm would once again give me a little cover, and I could stop for something to eat on the way back. So with my immediate future neatly and pleasantly planned, I headed out to the parking lot, got into my car, and drove south. The rain had started by the time I got to Matheson Hammock, and so once again I pulled on my sporty yellow foul-weather gear and jogged down the path to McGregor's boat. I picked the lock again quite easily and slipped inside the cabin. During my first visit to the boat, I'd been looking for signs that McGregor was a pedophile. Now I was trying to find something a little bit more subtle, some small clue to the identity of McGregor's photographer friend. Since I had to start somewhere, I went back down to the sleeping area. I opened the drawer with the false bottom and flipped through the pictures again. This time I checked the back as well as the front. Digital photography has made sleuthing a great deal more difficult, and there were no marks of any kind on the pictures, and no empty film packets with traceable serial numbers either. Any clod in the world could simply download the pictures to his hard drive and print them out at will, even someone with such hideous taste in footgear. It didn't seem fair. Weren't computers supposed to make things easier? I closed the drawer and searched through the rest of the area, but there was nothing that I hadn't seen before. Somewhat discouraged, I went back upstairs to the main cabin. There were several drawers there, too, and I flipped through them. Videotapes, action figures, the duct tape, all things I had already noticed, and none of them would tell me anything. I pulled the stack of duct tape out, thinking, perhaps, that there was no sense in letting it go to waste. Idly, I turned over the bottom roll. And there it was. It really is better to be lucky than to be good. In a million years, I couldn't have hoped for something this good. Stuck to the bottom of the duct tape roll was a small scrap of paper, and written on the paper was Riker, and under that, a telephone number. Of course, there was no guarantee that Riker was the Red Ranger, or even that he was a human being. It could well be the name of a marine plumbing contractor. But in any case, it was far more of a starting place than I'd had, and I needed to get off the boat before the storm stopped. I stuck the paper inside my pocket, buttoned up my rain slicker, and snuck off the boat and onto the footpath again. Perhaps I was feeling so happily mellow from the after effects of my evening out with McGregor, but as I drove home, I found myself humming a catchy little Philip Glass tune from 1,000 Airplanes on the Roof. The key to a happy life is to have accomplishments to be proud of and purpose to look forward to, and at the moment, I had both. How wonderful it was to be me! My good mood lasted only as far as the traffic circle where Old Cutler blends into Lejeune, and then a routine glance in my rearview mirror froze the music on my lips. Behind me, practically nosing into my back seat, was a maroon Ford Taurus. It looked very much like the sort of car the Miami-Dade Police Department maintained in large numbers, for the use of plainclothes personnel. I didn't see how this could possibly be a good thing. A patrol car might follow for no real reason, but someone in a motor pool car would have some kind of purpose, and it looked like that purpose was to make me aware I was being followed. If so, it was working perfectly. I couldn't see through the glare of the windshield to know who was driving the other car, but it suddenly seemed very important to know just how long the car had been following me, who was driving, and how much the driver had seen. I turned down a small side street, pulled over, and parked, and the Taurus parked right behind me. For a moment, nothing happened. We both sat there in our cars, waiting. Was I going to be arrested? If someone had followed me from the marina, it could be a very bad thing for Dashing Dexter. Sooner or later, McGregor's absence would be noticed, and even the most routine investigation would reveal his boat. Someone would go to see if it was there, and then the fact that Dexter had been there in the middle of the day might seem very significant. It's little things like this that make for successful police work. Cops look for these funny coincidences, and when they find them, they can get very serious with a person who is in too many interesting places by mere happenstance. Even if that person has a police ID and an amazingly charming fake smile. There really seemed nothing for me to do except bluff my way through, find out who was following me and why, and then convince them that it was a silly way to waste time. I put on my very best official greeting face, got out of my car, and stepped briskly up to the Taurus. The window rolled down, and the always angry